And I'm trucking on, I'm trucking on. Well, I'll move her on down the line. Another time will do me fine. I'm trucking on.
Howdy, friends, and welcome to Trucking On. I'm your host, Ward Richmond. I really appreciate you tuning in today, and I hope you enjoy the show. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the premiere episode of Truckin' On. So happy to have you here with me. Thanks for checking this out. I hope you enjoy it. This is my first official episode of Truckin' On. You might hear me refer to this podcast as the Supply Chain Real Estate Podcast in this upcoming episode. However, after episode number one, I decided to rename it. Literally minutes after we finished recording it, I decided to rename the podcast Trucking On, because this is not really about supply chain real estate necessarily. I'm going to talk to people from all different walks of life. There's going to be a lot of supply chain real estaters on here, no doubt. And we're going to talk about that because that's what I do for a living. I love talking about it. But what I really want to talk about are the people that I encounter in my life that inspire me, and I want to learn from them. I want to hear their stories, and we're going to start right here with my best friend, John Pettigo, and so thankful to have him in my life for all these years, and we're going to talk about how we met, grew up together, played in many bands together, pursued the dream, and manifested said dream, realized said dream, and got to play music together for a living for many years during our 20s and travel the world together. And we're going to tell you all about how we made that happen. And then I'm going to attempt to draw some parallels between the music industry and the real estate industry. And then we're going to talk about my badass friend, John Pettigo, and what he's been up to for the last 17 years since we parted ways and we stopped touring together. And it was an incredible experience getting to do this with John, and he taught me how to use all this equipment. And we decided to get on an airplane and fly down to Mexico and do this on the beach. So hope you dig it and enjoy. Welcome to Trucking On. Let's go. John and I, we met in elementary school, but we really became friends in high school when we were randomly paired together for a project in our theater arts class. And our job was, for the final exam, was to do a commercial. So instead of doing an actual commercial, we wrote a song together. So this is the first song I ever wrote. John was already a skilled guitar player, and we decided to write a song. We co-wrote the lyrics, and then he wrote the music, and it was an advertisement for our fictitious hot dog factory called Ward and John's Wiener Factory. That's right. The song went on to be very popular at Woodrow Wilson High School. And, you know, for years, our friends in the show choir would sing along with all the words. We went on to create a punk rock band called South. And by my senior year of high school, we were performing in Deep Ellum. This was really the beginning of my foray into cold calling and business in general. And how did we learn how to do it? We asked for help. So without further ado, I'm going to bring John Pettigo into the conversation here, and we can start talking about this. And we're going to talk about what we did with our music business, and then what we've done since the time we stopped playing music together for a living. And we'll go from there. So hope you enjoy the show. John Pettigo, what's up, my brother?
Howdy, man. It's good to be here in Tulum with you, bro. We're having a good time. So far, the best of times.
That's right. It's your birthday weekend too.
I know. It's my birthday tomorrow. And just a matter of hours, I'm gonna be older than I was moments ago.
John asked me how old he's turning this year earlier.
That's because you beat me to the age, and I knew you'd know.
Yeah, I know, because I just turned 44, so he's about to turn 44 too. So congratulations. We're still in our young 40s.
Yeah.
Early 40s.
But as we discussed earlier, you know, we still act young. You know, I feel like I haven't really aged since, you know, we first met. And I think that's a good way to look at life. You know, you want to act young, be responsible, you know, pay those bills. But come on, man, let's have some fun with it.
Exactly. Yeah. My mom over Thanksgiving a couple days ago was telling me she might be slightly concerned about us going to Tulum together. And she said, well, you know, at least you guys are adults. And I said, Mom, that is highly debatable if we're going to be behaving like adults. And she said, that's what John's mom said to her too. So Jane Pettigo and I are on the same page still.
That's right. Our moms are talking.
Our moms still talk. They're still friends. It's beautiful. So dude, like when we were in high school, you played in this garage band called the Amnesiacs.
That's true.
And I saw y'all play in the garage and I was like, man, I want to play in a band big time because I thought it was so cool. So I stole John from the band and then like, well, you didn't want to like also be the guitar player in my band because that would have pissed off the Amnesiacs. So you learned how to play drums for my band, South, that I, you know, like our band.
That's right.
Band. And how was that learning how to play the drums? How did you do that? Because you didn't know how to play the drums when we decided to start this band called South.
I feel like with most things in life, I kind of intrepidly go into things and I think, oh, you know, how hard could it be? So you just kind of figure things out, right? Like it's like anything I've ever done. Like I've learned the banjo the same way. I've learned every instrument the same way. Even like technology, computer programs, recording equipment, whatever. You just kind of have to figure it out. And if you have a deadline, like I think we probably set a show up or something and we were probably like, we have to function by this time. And it might've been like a school dance or something. I remember playing at one
the decade dance.
Yeah, the decade dance, right. It was in the lunchroom or whatever at Woodrow.
They regretted booking us.
Did they pay us or did we play for free?
We played for free for sure. It was cool though.
Yeah,
I learned how to play. I got the bass because I felt like it was the easiest instrument to learn how to play because I didn't know how to play an instrument. And John and our friend Jason, who was in the band as a guitar player, both kind of taught me basically how to play really basic bass lines. And I've always liked writing lyrics and I would study lyrics of songs like from the time I was in elementary school and memorize them and write them down and things like that. I would write down like Ghetto Boys lyrics on the bulletin at church on Sundays and get in trouble.
Keep around corners. My mind's playing tricks on me.
That's right. I like Gangster of Love. It's one of my favorite Ghetto Boy songs. It's very good. I'm not going to quote the lyrics today. I still know them though. And so we wrote songs. They were all about like, basically we were kind of like Taylor Swift before there was Taylor Swift and wrote songs about the girls that had done us wrong.
That's right.
We had some pretty, pretty great songs.
Yeah. We covered the gamut, you know, about all the girls in our high school. I mean, we could say names, but that's probably not a good idea. But, you know, we're pretty overt about who they were about. You didn't even try to like change the names or anything. You just said, girl's name, and then you said what was...
Called me an asshole.
yeah, that's right.
That was the song.
Yeah. She called you an asshole.
We had explicit lyrics in high school, and everyone just let us get away with it because, you know, that's what pop stars do these days and back then as well.
And we didn't get canceled by singing about our wiener factory at that point. So it was okay.
We kept it rolling.
That's right.
But yeah, so, you know, I wanted to start a band. So what I did, I went and found the guy that was playing in a band and I asked him, how do I start a band? And we did that. And then we found another friend of ours, Dan Phillips. I'll never forget. We like had to track him down because Dan was already like playing shows and everything. And Dan taught us how to book shows, which basically, at least back then, I know things are different now. This is pre-YouTube, pre-SoundCloud, pre-MP3, all that stuff, pre-Napster. It was 1995, I believe. And we would record on a 4-track mixer, like we're doing today, actually, on this podcast. Brings back old memories.
And then we like took a photo, wrote a band bio, and then we took them and like mailed them or dropped them off at all the clubs in Deep Ellum in the Dallas area, the entertainment district. And then they had like booking hours where you would call in, because this is before email. And we would just cold call them basically and beg them to let us play. And then that's what Dan told us to do. That's what we did. And he let us name drop him. So that went a long way. And then we started booking shows. Then we both went off to college. We both went to school in New England. We would play some shows up there, but then in the summers and winters, we would come home. And I would say, like, John became a masterful guitar player and frontman. I was not the best singer. He always allowed me to sing like 10 to 20% of the songs.
You say more than that.
But yeah, but we eventually broke up south. We started a band called The Fenders, which was a cover band. And then we started Slick 57 in 1998 and started doing our own original rockabilly songs. I stayed on bass. I started playing upright bass, which I found a guy named Blackie Graham to teach me how to play the upright bass. And then I got also a VHS tape that I studied like more than I studied in college and learned how to play like the slap rockabilly style bass. And then we got home that summer in 98, started Slick 57 officially then. And John became the lead guitar player, lead singer. And then we had like 20 drummers over the next decade for Slick 57. But in college, we'd play summer breaks, winter breaks. We started just playing Dallas every night. And then the next summer after sophomore year, we started going like into Oklahoma and Austin and San Antonio and Houston. And then after we graduated, then we moved in together into an apartment in Dallas. And I mean, our goal was like get signed to a record label and quit our jobs and go on tour for a living. And then we started asking around people that are signed to record labels, and we got help from them. And we basically made a list of every record label that would put out our kind of like rockabilly country music and around the world. And again, we mailed out hard copy press kits of CDs and pictures and our band bio, and sent them to all the record labels around the world, and then told them that we're going to be performing at the South by Southwest Music Festival. And we did not have a gig there, but we found a way once two record labels agreed to come see us play, and we got a couple gigs booked. The record labels came, then Stuart Coop, my main man in Sydney, Australia, of all places, with Laughing Outlaw Records, signed us to a record deal. And that was in March of 2002. October of 2002, I quit my job. John quit his job. I don't know what your job. I had a kind of a corporate job. You were like working at Western Warehouse.
Yeah, some kind of like dubious type of.
You had a lot of jobs during that time.
I feel like
CD World.
If I drive around Dallas, like every couple of minutes, I'll be like, I worked there for a minute, you know. But I think we were, you know, it was like you were saying earlier, like we were asking for help. We went in with kind of blind faith that it was going to work. And because I think we did believe it was going to work. And in many ways it did. We got to go to Europe. We got to go to Australia. We got to go around the country a million times, you know, like countless times for better or worse. And I think that's the whole purpose, you know, connecting with people, right? Isn't that the idea?
Tell them how we like booked. It's because like Australia record label booked us a plane ticket to Australia, and they booked us a month-long tour there and had it all set up with a tour manager and everything. It was really easy peasy, but we really wanted to tour Europe and they couldn't book us in Europe. So we negotiated like the ability to do a 1 month layover in Europe on the way to Australia, and they couldn't book it. So we decided we'll book our own European tour. Like once we had the layover established and the plane tickets bought, then we got to it. So do you remember like those days?
Yeah, because, well, you know, we were asking, our buddies were in a band called Slobberbum. And I think we were like just trying to figure out how to get over there, because they kept telling us that, you know, or we kind of knew that they were huge over there, or be relatively big in the Netherlands at least. And so we were like, okay, if we can get over there, maybe we can kind of parlay and play off of them. And they were playing in London. So I think we were like, okay, if we can jump on a bill with them in London, that would kind of be, you know, a pretty good starting point where we could actually play in front of a crowd. So that kind of, I think that's really what started it. And then Ward and I, we got up, we would get up at 4 or 5 in the morning or whatever and start calling the same you would do here, but it was, the time was there, you know, you had to get up early. So we get up like 5 in the morning. Thank God, like my parents allowed me to call internationally. As much as we did, it probably cost a fortune back then, you know? But we'd call and just try to book, and somehow they would book us. I don't even know why. Like, we had nothing to show. There's not like there was like an internet thing yet. We might have had a website or something, but barely used it.
We were very convinced that we were the next big thing, and I think that came through.
It had something to do with our obsession with Britney Spears and how we knew we were going to meet her one day.
I've spent a lot of time like studying sales in the last few years or 5 years or so, but back then I didn't study sales, but we were doing it naturally. A lot of things I've like learned today to be conscious about in sales, but there's nothing like easier to sell than a product that you actually believe in. And I think we truly believed in the product we were selling, even though no one had heard of us. We were not famous, like no one knew us, but I think our persistency, and then, you know, targeting the right places to play, which we did by finding bands that we felt like we were aligned with and see where they played in Europe. And then we called those clubs. So we called those clubs. Then we called their booking agents too, got booking agents to pay attention to us so that we could get a European booking agent and go back again. And then anyway, we went on tour. We booked a European tour. It was wild. It was like London all over the, I mean, it was not the best like organized tour from a geographical perspective. I think we went London, Paris, Amsterdam, Dresden, Germany. That was a long drive.
Yeah, the first show was really in Dresden. After London. So we
in Paris. We played the Hard Rock Cafe.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So we did London, and our buddy hooked us up with a hotel room, which was very nice of him. And then we channeled over to Paris and played at the Hard Rock, and we got to stay with our friends. You know, you just call around and got help. And then, yeah, then we went to Amsterdam and
we got a tour manager because Slobberbone guys hooked us up with their tour manager.
Right.
And he, I mean, we thought that he might like, murder's a strong word. And, you know, we were pretty scared though. We were in the warehouse and he was basically yelling at us like, who the F are you guys? I've never heard of you before. What are you thinking being here? Because we didn't have a label representation or anything, but I still had some, that 401k I cashed out of my corporate America job, and I had a credit card and I just gave him the credit card and he ran. He's like, okay, fine. And then we had a great European tour. I think we broke even. So that's a good thing on your first tour. And then we went to Australia for a month, and then we basically went on to tour together. I always think of it like that we played around 200 shows a year for 4 years. Went back to Europe multiple times and toured around the United States, working the same formula, just cold calling people constantly and being on the road. And then, you know, it went from being my dream job and the best thing I could ever imagine happening when I was 23 years old when we left to go to London on that first tour. And after 4 years, like, I mean, sad to say, but John and I barely spoke to each other.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure.
We were not best friends, BFFs anymore at that time, really. We were, but we weren't. We would talk about scheduling shows and then say, see you at the show, buddy. And anyway, I stopped having as much fun. I can only speak for myself, but I think we were just like going in different directions. And I was partying too hard.
I was gonna say, you were living your best life.
I was living my best life. And it was taking a toll on me. I knew like, this can't continue or I might die. It was pretty crazy. I mean, when you're playing 200 shows a year and you're partying hard, it's a lot, as you can probably imagine. And anyway, in March 2000, or I guess August of 2005, we had a month-long European tour booked, all festival shows, and then we decided that we could make more money playing at home with our cover band in Dallas and waiting. I waited tables. You worked at like in a warehouse or something.
Yeah.
But we were going to break even in Europe for a month or stay home and make money. And so breaking even for a month also meant bills. So then we would have lost money. And
we were also on a reg deal where we didn't pay our electric bill because we would be out of town for months at a time. Mm. So we were like, well, why would we pay that? We're not even going to reap the benefit of it.
Oh, yeah.
Such idiots.
We lived, we were trying to think how much we made a year during those years. And I feel like $15,000 a year per man would be on the high side.
Yeah, I would
say. We were living bare minimum. And I mean, I'd borrow toilet paper from the restaurant, cafe that I worked at.
I remember your mom heard about us stealing toilet paper from that Black Forest Cafe and
movie theaters.
And cried, I think, at you, literally.
We would sneak into movie theaters. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, that was like how we spent our days. But, you do what you got to do. I'd say with inflation, what we lived on was pretty, maybe 30 grand now,
$30 grand now, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. It's like nothing. You can't really survive. It was hilarious.
And anyway, March 2006, I've quit officially touring. I still played music. We still continue to play music together for a long time. Still do, actually, on occasion. But that's when I started my job in commercial real estate. And so when I got into commercial real estate, I was 27 years old. And that was 2006, and I decided to industrial. And see, I'm bringing back in supply chain real estate because this is the supply chain real estate podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You might have
forgotten. I thought it was the history of Ward.
you have to introduce, you have to introduce the a little bit of the personal background, I think, to really lock people in. Mm-hmm. By the way, everyone, I've heard this on all the podcasts I listen to, but please be sure to give us a 5-star review and refer us to your friends. We'd love to have you back. Hopefully this is the first of many. Who knows? It might be the only one. It might not ever get published, but I'm having fun today. When I got into commercial real estate, guess what I was told to do? Make a list of all the buildings and all the tenants in a certain area that I was going to specialize in. In Dallas, I remember the 75207 and the 75247 zip codes, and then go call all those people and beg them to hire us. And I was like, that sounds mighty familiar. And it was nice. This is a very long-winded way to say that I think from my experience, the music industry and the commercial real estate industry have a lot in common when it comes to that. And then I imagine every industry does. And it is creating something of value that you believe in, hopefully, and then telling the people who benefit from that value you create about the value you create. And so when I started doing it, some of my peers that were also just getting started were complaining about it. And I was like, dude, cold calling someone about helping them with their warehouse lease is like, to me, it was so much easier than like cold calling a nightclub in Germany with a booking agent that barely spoke English and trying to get him to pay us to play a gig. And he never heard of us before. And, but very similar, and not to say commercial real estate sales is not tough as well, but, I will always feel like playing in the band gave me an edge getting started. It was the best sales training I could ever imagine having because we were selling something that basically didn't exist. And
yeah, we were the snake oil salesman. But I guess when you're selling real estate, like people want that already. It's not like you're just going out of nowhere. People need space.
Yeah, they don't need Slick 57 playing at their club. That's for sure.
For sure.
We needed to play the club. And we made it happen somehow. And but that process of doing it repeatedly and continuing, I mean, the persistency of it and the focus on that goal, like eventually paid off. And I think that gave me a lot of faith in business, like that if you focus and you have a desired outcome that doesn't change and you persistently tell people about what you want, then you can go get it. So that's a little real estate. And I mean, you know what I want to hear about? I mean, that's my real estate career. Now I've been doing it, 2006 to now. So a long time. That's
16 years,
almost 17 years in March. And it's been wonderful. We're going to get into throughout this podcast as we roll on. I'll talk about different strategies that I've discovered over the years that we use or those that didn't work that we stopped using. We'll talk about market trends, research reports, very sparingly, because I think a lot of that information's out there. I want to certainly talk to other people in the industry and business leaders in general that are doing that, and from all walks of life, all different businesses. And today, John is here in our presence. And when I left to pursue my job in real estate, John has continued on for 17 years in the music industry, which from my experience in the music industry, I feel like it is like one of the toughest industries that there is out there. And so like major respect to you, my brother. And
oh, yeah.
You went on to play in some other bands, and you played in Rose County Fair for a while after like we stopped touring with Slick 57. Our band Boys Named Sue, we were a pretty big deal in the late aughts. Mm-hmm. We won Best Country Band in the Dallas Observer Music Awards mm-hmm. multiple times. And we had so much fun playing in the Sues. But then, I mean, I feel like as a musician, you had your breakthrough, like of all breakthroughs, with the O's, right?
Correct. Yeah, O's. Yeah. So I started the O's in 08. Our first record came out in 09. And then, that band just toured relentlessly for 10 solid years. And I would say the pandemic pretty much was kind of the nail in the coffin. I mean, we still play here and there, and we have a radio show every Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. in Dallas on 95.3 The Range.
KHYI.
That's right. But you know, like music industry, I mean, industry is kind of a funny term because, you have to really love music and be passionate about it because, you know, it's not easy money. It's all hustle and you got to work your ass off for sure.
So you toured with the O's. You guys played like major festivals, did major tours in Europe and everything, and sold a ton of records, way more than Slick 57 ever sold. And but I do like have to come back into the picture because in 2013, I decided that I wanted to become a rapper.
That's right.
And we started a rap group called Party Police. And I just said, hey, much like when I decided to start a band in high school, I was like, hey, man, will you come be in the band? And he's like, I can play drums. I can learn how to play drums for your band. Like then with Party Police, like, hey, can you like be the DJ for me? And he'd never done DJ really production work before, right?
No.
And of course, John being like the ultimate creator and artist that he is, like, sure, I can do that. And so he became a DJ. DJ Pegasus was his DJ name. My rapper name is The Warden. The Party Police has been stripped from YouTube and iTunes for the time being. Until I reach the level of wealth where I get hand tattoos, I'm not going to put those back online. But if you're with me, I've been known actually like to be at a business dinner. We were at a business dinner one time and they had like, we were in the like closed off room because there were 15 of us or something. And they had a TV in the room. And then this Party Police came up because people knew about it. And I busted out one of my hidden YouTube videos on the big screen there. So we're still talked about. We made lots of crazy music videos. We played 3 shows. The last one we opened up for Ludacris, got booed off the stage.
That was very dangerous.
Ferociously. Got a beer bottle thrown in my head. It missed my head by like 1 inch. I mean, I was like using agilities that I had never used before in my life to dodge that beer bottle. And my daughter, Betty, was born about 2 months later, about 2 months later. And I felt like the beer bottle and the crowd chanting Luda, Luda throughout our entire set was the sign for me to stop being a rapper. However, John Pettigo went on to keep producing music, and that is like your main, I'd say it's like your main gig now, right?
Yeah, I definitely produce records.
So how did that happen? Like after, like your life crumbled when I told you Party Police wasn't going to continue. Everybody in Party Police, Madison King, my sister, who I convinced to join the band with us as well. I and John were both probably extremely relieved that I had decided to stop the Party
that
Boys.
Luda show. Yeah, she was hiding behind me and kind of saying, what are we going to do? Like, how are we going to get out of here alive? Basically, I thought we were going to get mobbed. But no, I mean, I started producing records because of Party Police. Like I was like, okay, I can get into this. And that kind of jump started me in learning how, you know, learning the tech for it. Like you have to kind of learn the
recorded Mike Cox with Speed Trucker, like kind of during that time, I feel like you started
right.
recording him.
Yeah. So I got paid from you, like for Party Piece, like what I got paid was basically I got the software and a microphone or whatever. And then with Mike, I got a couple more pieces of gear, you know? So it was like, yeah. And then I kind of slowly built up the...
And we recorded at your house.
Right. And then I slowly built up my stuff. And then I've gotten better and better at that. And now, you know, that's what
I
do.
So you've recorded lots of bands like that have gone on to huge levels of success in my mind of like the world of touring that we lived in, which is not the Taylor Swift world. It was more like this kind of underground alternative country Americana scene. But I mean, like in terms of where Slick 57 got and the O's got, I feel like your first big record that I remember is the Vandaliers.
Yes.
Where I'm like, damn, you've like gone to the next level as a producer, recording those guys, and Josh Fleming's an awesome dude. So talk about the Vandaliers, and then we got to get to the, like, you know, J-Ray.
Yeah. So Vandos, yeah, I did their first two records. Vandaliers, like their first one, me and Josh, the singer, like built the band. And it happened at my house. And it was like, I knew the sound that he was going for because you and I have a band, you know, Slick 57. So I was like, I already have the template. I was like, I know what this is supposed to be. And I knew what we had done wrong. And I was going to try to lead Josh in the direction that I knew would work better, you know, which is a poppier version of what we did. Kind of less hokey, kind of country and more, I don't know, just more pop to it. And so
less centered around alcohol consumption.
No doubt. And so I think we did a really good job. And since then, they've been killing. They're really going after it. And then, and I've done other things around, you know, that. And then, that led to the O's. Basically, we're playing in College Station, and we played with this band called Ottoman Turks. And the guitar player of that band was Joshua Ray Walker, who, you know, immediately I got along with, and we were drinking and having some fun. And then he said, I want to do an EP. So we started cutting some songs. And they were pretty good. He had a song, Working Girl, I thought that was pretty good. And then...
Love that song.
Yeah, it's killer. But I was like, what? Why aren't you doing a full-length record? And he said, I don't have any money. And I said, well, if you had money, what songs would be on it? And then he played a song called Canyon, which I was so shocked because I was in the control room and he was in the tracking room recording it. And I just said, play that one more time because I couldn't believe it. And I was so blown away. I literally had tears in my eyes. And then I said, what if you were going to make another song, what would be on that? And then he played a song called Lot Lizard. And I said, okay, give me a second. And I called Trey Johnson at State Fair Records. And I said, this is the guy. We're making his record.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in peace, of course. But I said, this is the dude this is happening. Like we're making this record with this label, you know? And he signed on real fast. I mean, and ever since then, like Josh has just been skyrocketing. He's about to go back and do the Opry again in March. which is cool. I got to play with him the first time, but this time our buddy Trey, who played with Slick 57, is on drums with Josh, and he gets to play with Josh this time around at the Opry.
It was cool. I saw them play. I saw Josh play with the band at Green Hall back in May.
Oh yeah, it was like a fun night.
Basically sold out Green Hall, one of my favorite venues in the world. If you've never been, it's in Green, Texas, right outside of New Braunfels, down in the Texas Hill Country. And I was like watching Joshua Ray Walker on stage, who I've known Josh since he was like before you started recording him, just from hanging around the scene and whatnot when he like in his teens. And he's a good friend of mine too. And I love Josh, but like seeing him on stage and then you're on guitar and Trey's on drums, like Slick 57 was actually on stage minus the drunken bass player. But I was like, man, that brought tears to my eyes. And you know what I was thinking we should do? Like, I don't know if we can get permission to do this. And if not, then I'm going to do it anyway. But we got to play like Canyon so everybody can hear Canyon. We'll close out with that. And then everybody will get a tear in their eye and come back for more, hopefully. Thanks to Jay Ray. But man, that's like amazing. And I feel like it's just going to continue. And I recorded I write songs still quite often. It's really cathartic for me. I do that a lot in my spare time. It's a meditative thing for me to do. I recorded with John in 2016, a solo album, went nowhere. And, but then we recorded again last summer and we did a Boys Named Sue album, last summer and, or two summers ago, gosh, 2021. But the time from like 2016 to 2021, like 5 years, I remember thinking when we were in the studio last summer, like, dude, you've like gone from this where you were in 2016 to like being like a recording Mensa. And it's really amazing to see. So proud of you, brother. And
thanks,
glad
man.
To be here in Tulum doing my first ever real podcast with you. And man, what else? Is there anything else?
Man, what are you going to, like when you get like a million followers on the podcast, like what are you going to do with all those mad ducats, bro? You're going to buy a house down here in Tulum?
Yeah, I might. I don't know. I definitely want to live by the beach once I become a famous podcaster. So
that's right.
I'm going to have to figure that out. This is a pretty nice venue for podcasting here at a Howl at Tulum. We'd like to thank them for not officially sponsoring my first podcast, but
for
we're sponsoring
the money.
Their hotel.
Yeah. Accepting a credit card to stay here.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's get rolling and we can play Canyon by Joshua Ray Walker and leave everybody in a state of peaceful bliss. And we're going to go watch the World Cup. So peace out, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
But my feet can't take me far. This is by my own doing, so I tell stories at the bar. Yeah, I'm afraid of flying, afraid of falling, truth be told. I don't get close to edges, I'm afraid that I'll let go. I'm a big, big man, just in size or in stature, and turn to space that can't be filled. I'm a bottomless canyon without a drop to spill. Are you proud of me? Are you proud of what I do? I'm trying to be a better man than the one that you knew. I will miss you when you're not around, though I wasn't around for you. When your broken body's in the ground, I'll hope there's room for two. I'm a big, big man, not just in size or in stature, in terms of space that can't be filled. I'm a bottomless canyon without a drop to spill. Thank you. spill. Yeah, I'm a bottomless canyon without a drop to spill.
Thanks everybody for tuning in to this episode of Truckin' On. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, don't be shy. Please like, share, leave a 5-star review so that we can keep doing what we're doing. Stay safe out there on the road and keep on trucking. Adios. I'm truckin'.